Live. Catch the podcast on kaya959.co.za.
So all of last week, even before that, before we went on holiday, we've been focusing on Stilfontein. A lot has happened. Obviously, when we ended our conversation last week, Thursday, I said we need to come back to a conversation with David van Wyk. We need more time to explore a few things. But let's just talk about where we are right now. If you remember, the police decided that the operation is now done. They had what at the time were 78 bodies that they said they recovered. And remember that that operation in the end, that phase three in the end, essentially volunteers went in to go and, you know, recover bodies and so on. Not necessarily the police. So the crane itself was organized by the police, but the people that went down there were volunteers, community members. And then, you know, there were obviously reports about the fact that they can't do more. And the police called it off, saying it's done and we are moving on, and they're calling this a success. Lots of questions remain about what actually happened there. Executive Director at Mining Affected Communities in Action, Christopher Rutledge, is on the line with us just to give us a sense of what they make of how all of this panned out and where we are right now. Christopher, thank you so much for your time. Good evening and welcome.
Thank you very much for having us. We really appreciate that.
Give us a sense of, from where you sit, how do you view how all of this has panned out in Stilfontein?
Yeah, so, you know, on the one hand, I think it's very important for us to do that because, you know, we have had almost a first-hand view of how things have unfolded at Stilfontein. Yeah. And, you know, one of the difficulties is that we do try to remain objective, but at the same time, we're also very much aware that you are not dealing with an abstract academic question. It's really a question of life and death, and that's how we've always approached this matter. Mm. You know, one of the things that we noticed, first off, was the way that the police absolutely rejected the idea that we're dealing with humans. You know, and within the context of that, that was the message they started to give the South African public, that these are criminals, they are foreigners, they are less deserving of our consideration, our empathy, our humanity, and even constitutional rights. You know, and that is the making of a genocide. We've seen this happen across many, many societies where that diminishing of people's human value, for whatever reason, be they foreigners, whatever the thing is, be they Palestinians or whatever the reason is that those in power want to conjure up, the fact of the matter is that those in power, the state, they have a higher duty than anybody else to act to preserve and protect lives, firstly, and then secondly, the Constitution and its values. And we didn't see that unfold in Stilfontein at all. Quite the opposite played out. We found a state that was, like I said, blind to the humanity of it all, and absolutely determined to make a statement, as they did in Marikana, that they would deal with criminality in the ways that they have decided criminality must be decided. I mean, today we're dealing with Kumbutso Mseveni, who has been charged with corruption. Mm. So now I'm asking you, should we all then say she is guilty and therefore she must die, have no mercy for her? Because the crime that she's committing is probably 10 times worse than the crime that these poor working class men were engaged in. But nevertheless, the point is that we came across a state that was absolutely disconnected from the humanity of the liberation struggle that brought them to where they are. Mm. That brought us all to where we are. The values that underpinned that liberation struggle was conveniently forgotten at the altar of political expediency and populism, you know, because we understand that the South African popular sentiment is one of xenophobia. At least that is what is displayed in the public domain. And so, you know, governments attempt to play that card, to use that as a means to gain political support. And then at the cost of at least 87 lives and possibly more, because the stories that of the bodies that are still below are horrendous, and hopefully we will have time to tell you about all of those one day. But yeah, so from where we're sitting, we came up against the state that I last encountered, me personally, in the apartheid days, when we were up against a PW Botha who was pointing his finger at the terrorists, at the Swat Kafar, and you know, telling us that there will be no mercy and they will do what it takes to bring back law and order. I mean, it just shook me to the core that 30 years later, it is the liberation movement that now plays that role in protection of really capital and a few people who benefit from that system.
You know, I want us to highlight something that I think we're uncomfortable to talk about. And that's what you just highlighted here about the way in which certain narratives are portrayed. And in this instance, the narrative of foreign nationals and how they're resented in the country. But I want to hone in a little bit, because I've been speaking to community members for weeks now, and that's not the sense I got. And I'm just wondering whether I'm wrong about how they related as a community, that it wasn't necessarily the way in which the narrative has been, you know, laid out in the media and us onlookers. The attitudes are not that black and white. They're not about foreign nationals, this, foreign nationals, that. The issue for them is the economics of their living conditions and a mine being present there and an economy. And they have a relationship with this economy of sorts that's a bit more complex than just us saying foreigners and non and nationals, you know, South African nationals. Just maybe give me that nuance there, please.
Yeah, no, indeed, 100%. I mean, Stilfontein is a typical mining town.
Yeah.
Where across the southern African continent, people have been brought in historically. Colonial practices meant that they would source labor from all these different places, from the Eastern Cape, from Mozambique, from Malawi, from Lesotho, everywhere else but from the area that the mine is. And that was partly a strategy to keep people divided. And they've done that very well. Nevertheless, so Stilfontein, that community, you'll find there is no sense of xenophobia, because there is a multinational community, a cosmopolitan community in the true sense. What South Africa and what Africa needs to really be, that community shows that in abundance, that it's possible to live with each other, and that you know, ethnicities and artificial borders are not what should divide us. Nevertheless, the point, I think, is absolutely correct. And the other point that you make about the economy, that one I want to maybe just touch on for a second, because Mr. Mantashe, the minister, you know, he keeps on saying that this is an economic crime. Now, again, perspective matters, and where you come from matters, right? So if he is the Minister of Mineral Resources and Energy, and he's speaking to bosses, right, and he's speaking to the other mining kingpins, the legal ones, and they say to him, look, this illicit mining is a problem. We are not getting the benefit of this minerals that have been extracted, et cetera, et cetera. And so Gwede approaches this from a point of view that this is an economic crime against the country. But you see, what he doesn't get is the point that you made earlier, that Stilfontein is surviving, and to some extent they were almost thriving in certain parts of the community through that economy that was created by that mine. We know for a fact that, well, at least it has been claimed that that mine closed down while there was still something like $30 billion worth of ore to be extracted from that mine. But they didn't do it because, you know, it wasn't profitable for them as a large-scale mine.
Yeah, yeah.
So as a small-scale mine, you're quite able to do that. And the miners actually showed that that is possible. And that wealth was distributed within that community. Mm. And it supported many businesses, many families. And that's why when this thing happened, when the economy was shut down, the Stilfontein economy was shut down, that's where the community came out and said, listen, you know, this is not as simple as people underground mining. This is the economy. And we've said to government, if you do what is done in Stilfontein and you do it properly, yes, you regulate it, then you will empower millions of South Africans, not just a few. You will empower millions of South Africans to be able to participate in the economy of South Africa. But now what the government has done, they've not only buried those people in the hole and they have, you know, perpetrated this horrendous act, they've also said to the people of Kuma, you must just be quiet and die in your silence, die in your poverty, because they have no plan for an economic recovery. Eh? Mm. There is nothing. So at least the miners created a way and said, listen, we can create an economy. Mm. Now, the fact that there are foreign nationals involved and that some of the money is certainly leaving the country, that's unfortunate. We've also said to them that we can deal with that. If South Africans are allowed to mine in the same way that large-scale mining companies are allowed to mine, but they have to have BEE partners, we could do the same kind of situation at the lower level, at the lower scale, and so create this wealth that then trickles into the economy. In fact, we've done studies where we've shown government, and we've given these studies to them, we've presented this evidence to them and say, look at this. This is our estimation of mining across South Africa, and this is how communities are benefiting. And they, I forget the number now, but I think it's, you know, 10 to 20-fold increase in, you know, exponential increase in the wealth of that community if there are activities that generate wealth.
Let me bring in here David van Wyk, a mining expert. We've spoken to him many times before. David, I said we need more time, and I'm really glad that you're able to join this conversation. There are many things that you've touched on before when it comes to, you know, artisanal mining and the mining industry, but I just want us to imagine there was the possibility of using the minerals that were still sitting in this, let's just focus on this one for now, in Stilfontein, and do it better. Do you believe that would have been possible?
Well, I think that we have always said that we need to transition from large-scale industrial mining in this country to medium, small, and artisanal mining. Because, yes, there is still some gold underground, and there's no reason why that gold should not come out. If the large-scale companies cannot do it because it's not profitable for them to do it, let the smaller-scale people come in and let them do it, because they might do it profitably and retain those towns. However, at the same time, while we are saying that, we need to imagine that gold is not renewable, and therefore mining is not sustainable. So ultimately, we've got to plan or situation beyond mining. At the moment, we're just allowing mining towns to die, and we are allowing the infrastructure to go to waste. We are allowing it to be plundered. And that's because there's a scrap metal industry in South Africa that's making absolutely billions from selling the dismantling of our towns. And that's what we've got to stop. That is where, for me, criminality takes place. The first criminality, of course, is that one of the abandonment of mines. Mines should not be abandoned.
Yep.
The second criminality, of course, is the issue that people are not getting their benefits.
Mm.
The third criminality is that we are allowing the towns that have very good infrastructure across purposes that we just simply allowing to disintegrate and fall apart. And we shouldn't allow our country to fall apart, really. That's not why we had a liberation struggle.
If there was always, you know, everybody speaks about the economy of this country. If an opportunity lies before us, it's inevitable that someone is going to go and grab it. You may not like the fact that it's a criminal, but if it sits in front of you, somebody is going to grab it. Why is it so difficult for everybody to be on the same page about the fact that, yes, at a large scale, maybe this is no longer profitable, but we could have done something, number one, to allow it to be legal for artisanal mining to take place. And number two, once you take that out of the darkness and you're allowed to happen properly, you almost manage the criminality. In other words, you know, you protect the site, people can do this properly, and we all sort of benefit from this. What's so difficult, you know, and why can't it just be done?
Well, I think what is so difficult is that over the past 15 years or so, a lot of people got into the value chain of the illegal operations.
Yeah.
And I'm not talking about the artisanal miners that are underground and super exploited themselves. I'm talking about the syndicates, the guys with the guns. Mm. The guys who are underground are mostly the victims of the syndicates. Mm. If we look at the statistics for people dying as a result of crime around Zamazamas, it's usually Zamazamas themselves that get killed. And I can tell you why they get killed. They get killed because they have disagreements about what they should be paid for the gold that they are taking out from these gangs that control and run these rackets, these mafia-style rackets to exploit these guys. I can tell you, these guys who are going underground, they tell us that, look, it's the people who retrenched us. Or they say to us, it is the local police station. Or they say to us, it's a security company. Or they say to us, it's a local scrap metal dealer. In one case, even a chemist who supplies them with mercury, but also supplies them with bullets in the head if they don't agree to his prices. You know, the other thing which is very interesting is that I've looked at the newspaper articles and so on around the Midlands case, and the police know who these guys are. They know what the names of the gangs are. They know, you know, these big shots. And, you know, that guy that they're looking for in Stilfontein today, that is not a kingpin. Mm. A kingpin doesn't go near a mine. A kingpin is someone who drives a Mercedes-Benz or a BMW, lives in Sandton, and he controls the people with the guns. They are answerable to him. And you know, it's like the drug trade in South Africa. The people who trade the drugs, these East Europeans and so on that we read about in the newspapers, they all live in Rondebosch and in the fancy suburbs of Cape Town, and then they poison the townships around Cape Town. Mm. The same thing is happening with this particular industry that we are having now, because there is no effective state control. No, there's no effective state involvement and so on. And that's because officials in the state themselves have become part of the value chain of corruption here.
I want to bring in Christopher, come back in just to explain to me if you agree with the sentiments about the narrative we are throwing around of who the kingpins are, and if we know who the real kingpins are, why are we not going after the real people, not the low-hanging fruit?
No, indeed, I 100% agree with what David is saying. I mean, for the South African police to suggest that a kingpin was underground, it's the height of absurdity, actually. But it's also not it's not surprising, because throughout this entire process of the Stilfontein massacre, the police have misdirected the public, have provided information which is partly true but not entirely true, and then they have kind of massage the information to the extent that journalists were actually, you know, buying this narrative, hook, line, and sinker. For example, they said, there were these men with guns down below. Now, all the evidence that we had, including video evidence, when we sent videos down and people that came up, there were no video evidence of guns. Even in the videos that the police themselves distributed, there was no evidence of guns. Then they were telling people that the miners don't want to come out. And yet we knew that, and they knew that, and the court knew that there was no other alternative for miners to come out. So they kept on peddling all these falsehoods as a means, I'm not quite sure, to kind of justify their actions or misdirect the public. But either way, it was quite dastardly in the way that they've done it, you know. And I think maybe one of the possible explanations is that they found themselves in a corner, and now they had to produce evidence to justify why they had done what they had done. And so even this claim of the kingpin, it's absolutely ridiculous. And the community themselves are now absolutely scared, because they're saying now it can be any one of us. They could put up a picture tomorrow and they could point at any one of that people in the community and say, well, he's the kingpin, you know. And so there's absolute fear for the level of victimization. You know, one of the volunteers was arrested, well, not sort of arrested, but he was harassed by state authorities. Mm-hmm. You know, people are being pinned to their beds. People who are at work next door, they're behind locked doors, they're under armed guard, they can't move an inch, and yet they are chained to the bed. You know, so the levels that the state is going through to kind of, I don't know, justify its claim that people, that these are dangerous people, it's getting to be absurd, if you ask me.
So if we are, you know, kind of circling around the people who are not really the kingpins, who stands to benefit?
Look, again, like David says, there are many people who benefit off the economy of illegal mining or of artisanal mining that is not regulated. So there are many people in the chain. Even the police, according to the police's own information, if you go back and check what the police have been saying, they themselves know. They have characterized it within different layers. So all of these people that they are currently arresting and that they start to get, these are low-level individuals. They are not high on the list of kingpins. Then you go up, I think there's 6 or 7 levels. So the people that they're targeting here are the real bottom of the rung ladder. You know, these are the people right at the bottom. And yet they are making, and they have to probably justify, how do you kill almost 100 people, probably more than 100 people, if these are just low-level workers. So now they have to justify, but these are actually dangerous criminals, they are kingpins, they are, I mean, absurdness. When you go and look at their own intelligence reports, which they presented to the public, presented to Parliament, and presented all over the place, actually, you will see that they themselves know that the kingpins are located at a much higher level, even to the extent, as they were suggesting, at the corporate level. Mm. So that channel of money runs right up to a very well-connected individuals in society. And the fact that our state is prepared to murder, you know, almost 100 people to protect those individuals really needs us to take a step back and to say, what on earth is going on here? This is ridiculous. Surely, this is some kind of fable. Because we all know where the kingpins are, but you are murdering poor black men.
Mm. David, we now have what the police are saying, a successful operation. Is that how you would characterize this?
I don't think it's a successful operation. You know, last year in November, they closed 27 shafts around Rivoli and they put concrete caps over the top. I can show you a video that was taken on Saturday of one of these caps that have already been circumvented. It's very easy to get around these caps that they put up. Look, the thing is that it's to try and create the impression that the state is doing something. But the state is not doing what is required. And what is required is regulation, legislation, training, establishment of small business units, establishment of safety procedures, training in safety, the creation of a central buying agency to buy all the gold so that you can cut out the people who are at the moment benefiting from it, and so on. You know, these are suggestions that civil society has made to the state in the past, Makua, ourselves, and others. And these are not unreasonable suggestions. There are suggestions that can be carried out if there was the will to, in fact, carry them out. You know, so they will now move away, let's say, to Matabang or somewhere else, to Island Beach or to Virginia, and do a similar operation there. And then we find ourselves back in Stilfontein. And in no time, people will be going underground again because those mines are abandoned. Those mines are not being properly utilized. Those mines are not creating jobs. The people in Stilfontein and Kuma and so on, they are very desperate. If you The moment you move the police and the army out of the area, then the people will go back there. The other thing that I think that we must remember is that African people mined in South Africa for centuries before industrial mining. In fact, I can show you statements by the head of ISCOR in 1965 where he says, "We found the iron where indigenous people were mining." Mm-hmm. I can show you reports from hunters and gatherers and missionaries and other people that I have in my library where they say, there on where the Witwatersrand is today, mm-hmm. they will say they found African people mining there, mm-hmm. and that they suspect that there is gold because these people have got artifacts that are gold, mm-hmm. golden. You know, the idea that African people can only be cheap labor for white capital is an unacceptable idea. And it's something that we fought against in the liberation struggle, as Mr. Rutledge correctly put. You know, we were fighting for a transformation of the mining industry, for a liberation of the mining industry, so that people can benefit from the wealth of the country, which is not happening at the moment.
So in your view, I mean, I just want to quickly just ask also, what are these people being charged with? Because, you know, legislation makes it a bit difficult to, and I know what the police are saying, but what's really going on here? What are these people that are coming out that are being charged with?
Well, from what I've seen so far, people have been charged with trespassing, yeah. and they've been... And that doesn't stand, because if it's an abandoned shaft, mm. then they're not trespassing. Mm. The other thing that they could be charged with is illegal possession of minerals, but they're not possessing minerals. They've got bags of stones. Mm. And those bags of stones have to be crushed and made into powder and taken through a washing process with mercury before the gold is in fact extracted. So you can't even charge them with that. And this is why they're getting 6-month sentences, suspended for 6 years before they backed off to Lesotho. The other thing is about the weapons. In Rivoli last year, when they showed the weapons in the newspapers and so on, those looked to me pretty much like weapons that went into the last amnesty for weapons when gun owners handed in their guns. They didn't look like weapons of war to me. And we don't know whether those weapons came out of the armory of the police force or whether they indeed came out of the tunnels underneath. The other thing is that they always create the impression that Zamazamas are shooting at communities. It's simply not true. The people who are getting shot are Zamazamas themselves.
Yeah, it's a battle between themselves, right?
Yeah. Well, it's a battle between syndicates who want to control them. Another battle between themselves.
Yes.
You know, most of the Zamas that I've spoken to, and I've done this for 20 years, they will tell you they want to be regulated. They want to be legislated. They want to be legal. They want to be rid of the people who are riding on their backs.
Christopher, again, your question to what it exactly that you are hearing that they're being charged with.
No, I have to concur. So that seems to be the case. That all that they can be charged with is, I was in court through one of the processes, and what seems to be happening is that the state is threatening these young men. You know, they've just come out of out of hell, if you will, quite horrendous conditions, and now they're in jail, and they are being threatened by the state. So we don't know what the state is threatening them with, probably long jail sentences. And so what they end up doing is that the state then brings them before court, charges them with something called illegal mining. Right? Now, that's something that is found under the NPRPA, it's very vague. It's like David said, completely hard to prove. It's almost impossible to prove under these circumstances. So they cannot prove it. But yet these men, some of them have then pleaded guilty to this because they're not getting proper legal representation. Mm. They are being threatened. So these mostly foreign migrants plead guilty to it, and then they get these long suspended sentences.
Mm.
But in the case of most of the South Africans that we've been able to get to, you know, even on one occasion, we tried to find one of the South Africans, and the police led us on a wild goose chase for almost 3 weeks. Eventually, we tracked him down in court, And then we were able to give him some legal advice, because what they would wanted to have done is to do the same thing, threatening with long sentences. They come in and plead, and then they plead guilty, rather, and then the judge sentences them to these nonsensical almost sentences of, 6 months suspended for 6 years, which means, very little in the bigger scheme of things. So there's nothing really that they can be charged with. Other than those three things, and the state has been trying to, make a meal of it, trying to suggest that it is really, really kind of harsh sentences and, harsh criminals. But if one sits down in the cold day of light and you analyze it and you compare it and you really make a objective assessment of what this operation has cost, both in terms of money and in terms of lives, how it has, been done without involving people and finding solutions. And you look at the sentences that were handed down and the overall, you have to come to the conclusion that this was a farce in many ways. It can't be real. I mean, the stuff, and this is why we're saying we have to have some sort of commission. Because if you test the police's version of almost everything that has happened up against, the cold day, light of day, then I think we're going to see that what has unfolded here, it's both a tragedy and a farce.
So, David, let me ask you, in the end, Christopher says it was a farce, essentially. In your view, has this moved the needle in any way whatsoever in getting us closer to a better outcome with these abandoned mines, or not really?
Well, I think that the fact that the Minister of Mining only made an appearance right at the end of the whole story, and I was speaking to an international journalist that spent 2 or 3 days there over the last week, who told me that she felt that this was almost surrealistic. It was like a horror movie. It was like it wasn't real. I think that the absence of the Minister of Mining at the event and his lack of discussion about what are the solutions? How do we go forward? How do we liberate mining in this country? Because it still needs to be liberated. It is not liberated if it is still in the hands of the old multinational corporations, and then a few members of the political elite who get 27% of the shareholding. That's almost like the apartheid land distribution of 13% land to the African majority. Here we've got now 27%. Access to mining to the African majority, and the most of the people in the country and in the region are excluded from the benefits of mining other than cheap labor. So we cannot, in 1994 we didn't address the issue, and now the issues we didn't address in 1994 are coming back to bite us. We need to address the critical contradictions that face our society. And those contradictions are causing the unemployment, causing the inequality, causing the injustices that we see, causing the fact that, the majority of people still live in dismal poverty. And it's not sustainable. Just like mining is not sustainable, continuing with this kind of economy that we've got now, especially around mining, and not moving towards full liberation. And full liberation means indigenization, Africanization of the industry, and also means giving workers a more meaningful part in the economy and so on as well, rather than just being cheap labor and then just being abandoned. I've already told you there's 47 billion rands of unpaid pensions in pension funds, mainly to mine workers, with the fund managers pretending they can't find the mine workers to pay these pensions to. That is a crime. The 6,000 abandoned mines, that is a crime. The mining companies walking away from their responsibilities towards mine closure and rehabilitation, that is a crime. Repurposing and re-engineering these mines towards small-scale and medium-scale mining is another crime. And where the minerals have been mined out, not repurposing that for a just transition in mining and energy, that is a further crime. You know, so I really think that it's time that we begin to speak the truth and that we begin to engage around the truth to find real solutions and not pretend solutions.
I really, really appreciate you making time for us again today, mining expert David van Wyk. And I also want to thank Executive Director of Mining Affected Communities in Action, Christopher Rutledge. Thank you so much. Thank you to both for your insights and to just expanding a bit more on this conversation. I suspect we'll have this conversation again where there are developments. It seems to me like things are going to be moving. It's not the end of the story, but we'll obviously keep an eye on it.
If you missed it live, catch the broadcast on kaya959.co.za.